From Beyond Marketing, it's the 20-Minute Call, a podcast about the dreamers, boundary pushers, rebels, and champions of the skydiving industry. Each episode is a narrative journey highlighted by the highs, lows, and luck that the skydiving industry delivers, as told by the most influential people within the sport. If you've ever dreamed of becoming a skydiver, perhaps opening a drop zone, or becoming the next world champion, check out the 20-Minute Call hosted by me, James LeBarry. My guest today is a living legend in the world of aerial cinematography. Tom Sanders has shot countless TV commercials and films that have been seen by audiences all over the world. Some of his work includes the iconic commercials with Mountain Dew, Sony, and Honda, and feature films including three iconic James Bond productions, and, of course, the movie that would change the course of skydiving history, 1991's Point Break, featuring Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves. Tom was also the lead camera flyer for one of the world's most iconic demonstration jumps ever made, the jump into the opening of the 1988 Olympic Games in Seoul, Korea. With his incredible resume and high standards of excellence, Tom has received two of skydiving's great awards, being an honorary member of the U.S. Army Golden Knights and a member of the International Skydiving Museum and Hall of Fame. It doesn't get better than that. Please welcome Tom Sanders. Hey, Tom.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad that we finally got this to come together for both of our schedules.
I am too. That's quite a resume.
Yeah, well, I'm 70 years old.
Before we get into your accomplishments, because we know of what many of those are, but tell me about your background. I know of what you've done, but I don't really know a lot of kind of who you are, where you come from.
I grew up in Southern California, and I was really into surfing. I was a carpenter and a surfer, and didn't ever think about doing anything in the air. I was actually quite afraid of the air. I was normal fear of heights. The place that I used to surf in Southern California, I saw hang gliding. And that was one of the things that I always wished I could do, but I never thought I could do. And eventually when I got into skydiving, it opened up other things like base jumping and hang gliding. And so I spent most of my life in the air after I finally had the courage to make my first skydive and stuck with it. It was a tough first 25 to 50 jumps because I wasn't a good student and I was really afraid. But when we get into it a little bit more, I can explain why I was able to stick with it, because it wasn't something I chose to do. But basically, I was a Southern California surfer boy and a carpenter, and I would surf at a beach in La Jolla, and I could see hang gliders, and it just never, ever occurred that I could ever be comfortable in the sky. But that looked amazing to me. I don't remember a lot of my childhood. My parents divorced at a pretty young age, and I think I just kind of shut that out. One of the memories I really remember, and I probably was like 5 years old, is there isn't jumping there now, but in Lakeside, California, there was like a big park out there. It's called the El Monte Park, and we were going out there one day with the family for a picnic, and I remember seeing these beautiful colored things descending from the air. I didn't know what they were, but as they got closer and closer and closer, you could see there was like full-on human bodies underneath this. And these were old round paracommanders, but they're really brightly colored. And it was just one of the memories that I never, ever, ever forgot as a kid. And it's kind of weird, but it was really mind-blowing to see these beautiful things coming out of the sky that looked to a young kid like maybe flowers or something. And then it turned into these gorgeous parachutes, and I don't even think I knew what a parachute was, but then seeing real human beings underneath them, it was spectacular.
Wow. Who could have predicted the future then? What you would end up doing? If I'm not mistaken, you made your first jump because of your participation in a self-confidence building class. And this is in like the late 70s. So it's not even like, you know, skydiving is as accepted as it is today. So what is a self-confidence building class and how did you get there?
So it had nothing to do with skydiving, but there were a couple of real popular programs back there. One was called LifeSpring and one was called EST. They were controversial to some people, but basically my sister went through it and she liked it so much that she offered to pay for me to go through it. You're going to love this. Well, I ended up paying for it myself and I went through it. And in the advanced class, they would try to find something that you firmly believed was no way in hell you could do. There's just no way you'd be able to do this. And that would be what they called your holy grail. And you had to go do that. And the whole purpose of it makes a lot of sense. If you can go do something that you firmly believed that you could not do, then it kind of breaks up your belief systems. And it changed my whole life. So I went there. And again, I hadn't thought of skydiving ever since probably the time I saw it as a five-year-old kid. It wasn't anywhere near where most people lived. It was in the outskirts of towns like it is still today. It was not on TV at all. It wasn't a mainstream sport at all. It was kind of like, you know, you'd think of it as a real, I don't know, like Hell's Angel kind of thing. People jumping out of airplanes just didn't make sense back in the late 70s and 80s to most people. So it wasn't something you'd see on TV and think, oh, I want to do that. I don't think I ever saw it again. And I was literally in this classroom, and they would go around. It was a large group, and you had to come up with an idea that the people that were running it believed was really a true grail, or they would come up with something for you. And that even scared me more. I didn't know if they were going to make me sing in front of a group or something like that. There's plenty of things I'm still afraid of, plenty of things I was afraid of then. But as they were going around the classroom, it was so strange, but it was like a bolt of lightning, this idea of, oh, shit, skydiving. I could never do that. And then I went into a panic mode because I think, oh, I got to think of something better because there's no way in the hell I can jump out of an airplane. It just terrified me. By the time it got all the way around to me, I hadn't come up with a really good, reasonable. I always like to do the easy way out in a lot of things. I work really, really hard, but I don't like my life to be difficult. And I was trying to find something that they'd believe was a challenging thing. And maybe I thought it was challenging, but I thought, you know, maybe I could do it. I wasn't trying to play by the rules and do something I firmly believed I couldn't do, but I couldn't come up with a better answer. And so when it got to me, I said, skydiving. And that's how I ended to make my first jump. I dragged two other people that were in this class out there with me. And we went to Elsinore and we went through the training. And I didn't know it at that point because it was my first time in a drop zone, but it was really too windy to jump. But they would normally gear us all up. Of course, the wind might die down, but they knew it probably wasn't. And they put us all in the plane, and we went up in a DC-3 with probably 25 or 30 jumpers. And we circled around at 2,800 feet, and then they brought the plane back down. But that was just kind of their way. You've spent all day getting ready for a jump. They didn't just leave you on the ground. And there was a small chance that we'd get to jump. And so I had to come back the very next day. And if I'm not getting too wordy, I'll tell you about that night that I had to think about it. I didn't get to jump. And I went home, and actually I remember that was the last night of the class. So I actually didn't even get to do my grail before the class was over. But that night was the only night I remember ever in my life that I woke up with just the bed soaking wet from just sweat. I was like having a nightmare that I was supposed to go jump out of an airplane. That's how scared I was. I don't know if anybody's ever more afraid of jumping out of an airplane than me. And I woke up thinking, oh my God, that was a nightmare that I was going to go jump out of an airplane. And then I started thinking, oh shit, I went through that. I'm supposed to do that. And even though the class was over, somehow, I guess it was probably because the other two people that I had dragged out there, they still wanted to jump. And I had, you know, some pride and everything. I didn't want to go and not jump. And one of them was a cute girl. So the three of us go out there and we make a jump. And it was really, really kind of terrifying to think about it, but I had a good exit. Static line worked great. The parachute opened, and it was really quiet and peaceful. And I was certainly not over my fear of heights, but I was so excited, I went back up and made a second jump that day. And then I went on a glider ride because it was at Lake Elsinore where they had great sailplane activities there. So that was just busting out of never being in the sky at all. I spent, you know, the day there and did two skydives and a glider ride. And it was the moment that changed my life.
It changed your life when you knew, like, this is the direction. I have to do this more and more.
No, it was just, it gave me a lot of confidence. And what was really weird is I was an amateur photographer, but I had some pretty high-end equipment. I had like an 800 millimeter lens, and I'd had a photo published in Surfer Magazine of a guy getting in the barrel of a wave in California. It was the first time in my life I really thought I knew what I wanted to do. I was like 26 years old, and I was a little concerned that I didn't want to have a job that I didn't like, but I couldn't think of anything I wanted to do. Carpentry was nice, but I didn't think I wanted to do it forever. And when I sold this picture to Parachute or to Surfer Magazine, it was just a really that was kind of a light bulb moment that I wanted to be a photographer. This is kind of cool. I can't sing, I can't dance, but I really liked being creative. And it turned out like I really liked knowing what to put in the rectangle and the lighting and all that kind of stuff. So when I was at the drop zone, I noticed that you couldn't get a photo jumping out of an aircraft. And I personally don't like photos of myself all that much, but I thought there's a business here. And it's kind of hard for jumpers now to think back, but there was a day that there was no video recorders for consumers, and you really had to know how to load a camera. People would shoot with a still camera for weeks and think they still have photos going through the camera, and they hadn't got the film leader to catch on the take-up side, and they were just pushing the button and not getting photos. So it was way more difficult a long time ago. And then if you're going to get pictures of people jumping out of an airplane, it's even more difficult. But I got permission from the owner, who was an AMP mechanic as well, and he built this mount that I kind of designed, and we put a camera out on the it was on the cowling of the Howard aircraft, and I sold 3,000 photos that year. So I was a carpenter, but I was making more money on Saturday and Sunday filming students jumping out of an aircraft. I remember we charged $12 for an 8x10, and if they didn't like it, they got a full money back. And if they didn't pay in advance, they could come out and buy it for $15. So it was kind of a no-brainer. They could get their full money back, and they were jumping out of an airplane. And it was great because no friends 3,000 feet away are going to get a good photo of you. And here we got that moment of truth where you step off the aircraft. And that's what turned my whole life around business-wise, so I could eventually quit being a carpenter. It took me a while. I would work as a carpenter Monday through Friday. And Friday, by the time I was a semi-experienced jumper, we would do a sunset load on Friday. Saturday and Sunday, I would film students mostly with the wing-mounted cameras and on the cowlings of the aircraft. Going up in the DC-3 at the end of the Saturday and Sunday, we were filming 30 customers. And think of it business-wise. Nowadays, it's hard for a tandem a camera flyer. They're going one at a time with their customers. So even on a busy day, they're going to get 8 customers. All day long, there were students doing their first jump or coming back and doing their first free falls and everything. We could photograph them all day long because I had aircraft with cameras mounted on them, and the pilots or the jump masters would push the pictures. So I started this concession of photography, but then when the DC-3 went up, I could just lean out the emergency exit window, and I'm one cameraman with 30 customers. So it was much more lucrative photography business than I think it is today, where you're only going to get 8 customers in a busy day type of thing. So I did real well with it.
Tom, why are we still not doing that today?
Well, they don't do static line, for one. You know, that was the whole thing. It was with static line. All the customers were going out the same door, and in a DC-3, it was all on the same flight. And it wasn't too long after that that consumer video came out, and I actually mounted a video camera out on the wing of the DC-3. No, I mounted the still camera out there, so my hands were free. And I would videotape them gearing up. I'd videotape them walking to the DC-3. I'd videotape them in the airplane, stand in the door where they're all hooked up. And then through the emergency exit window, I could move the camera from inside the fuselage to outside, get a video of their whole deployment. And I'm getting a still picture, so I could actually operate the still camera and the video camera. So now I've got two things that I'm selling to them. The drop zone loved it because that was our form of Facebook. These people were going to show those photos. They show them to all their friends. And I paid a commission to the Parachute Center to have that exclusive concession. So I started that at Lake Elsinore in 1978, and I believe it was the first photography concession in the world featuring shooting amateurs doing something, you know. These were not professionals that were photographing. These are people on their first skydive. Nowadays, you can't go on a cruise ship without somebody trying to take a stupid photo of you eating dinner. You know, to me, I don't get it, but back in the day, that wasn't even a thing. So I think the photography concession that I started at Lake Elsinore was the first one, not only in skydiving that was a full-time business filming first-time students, but it was the first one for any activity in the world that I was aware of.
I imagine during that time, because there's no prerequisite to what you were doing, that your brain must have been going just a million miles an hour all the time, going, you know, how can I get X angle? Can I create or fabricate this mount, you know, to try and help monetize? I just imagine that would be a very exciting time as you found something that no one else had really figured out.
Yeah, it was really, really exciting. And one thing that worked for me even before I got deep into the skydiving photography is that I would normally have to drive 30 or 40 minutes to go surf. And when you're surfing, there's a whole lot of downtime. And I never got into meditation or yoga or whatever, but when I'm sitting on my surfboard out there in a very relaxed state of mind, I was just thinking constantly. And that's where I would come up with, you know, if I mounted a camera out on the wing of those airplanes, I bet you I could sell a lot of photos. And so I did a lot of thinking when I was out surfing. And that's also one of the reasons I was able to, later in my career, carry a lot of camera gear because on my head. Because when you're surfing, you're literally holding your head up for hours at a time. I get excessive. Like when I went surfing, I'd surf 4 or 5 or 6 hours. And so I had a really strong neck, kept me in really good shape. And so when I started skydiving, there happened to be some slow opening parachutes. The unit, the security unit, was notorious for opening so slow on the ground. People were looking up at me, and I'm not going through a lot of altitude, but I'm going through a lot of time for it to open. I mean, it literally, the slider wouldn't come down until I would unhook my swoop cords and reach up and pump the brakes and bring the slider down. It was just the kind of thing that surfing helped me with the muscles I needed to carry a lot of camera gear. And fortunately, there were some soft opening parachutes that helped as well. But the surfing was also a way that I did a lot of thinking and driving. And I just remember that I spent a lot of time driving to go surf, checking out the surf, going from one beach to the other, or being in the water. And I did a lot of my brainstorming out there sitting on a surfboard.
If you're a DZO or DZM listening to this podcast and you're not using Burble, I've got a question. Why not? If the reason is price, what's the cost of your time? Other booking and manifest softwares are a one-size-fits-all. Burble was built from the ground up by a DZO for DZOs to maximize efficiency. Now, isn't that nice? There's no software that compares. Choose Burble. Burble. Of note, in terms of you sort of fabricating, is your helmet. I imagine I'm making an assumption here that your carpentry skills help create what, really, I've never seen a helmet before or after yours that you were using in the early aspects of your career. I don't know if it was a bell, but it looks so solid and part of your head. We've all seen the pictures of you with all these, you know, cameras mounted back when the camera equipment was much more heavy, but was your carpentry background helping you to, you know, sort of like, how can, A, what's the best helmet for me? And B, how do I fabricate it to make it part of me?
Well, of course, back then there were no companies making skydiving helmets at all. There was no skydiving small businesses making any of the accessories that camera flyers benefit from today, just lights to let you know your video is on. None of that was available. We built our own battery packs. We built our own switches. But the early helmets were so simple that I could kind of fabricate something, but it needed to be more like a machinist skill. And it wasn't too long after I, you know, had a few hundred skydives that I started getting a little bit of Hollywood work. And there was a Hollywood machine shop that ended up building all of my original helmets, and they just did a magnificent job. So I could tell them what I wanted. They could see the cameras, and they would just build everything. So like if I had 3 or 4 cameras on there, they were all lined perfectly left and right and up and down. So I gave them a lot of guidance. But it was a machine shop doing that. I was never really good with machining parts. And a lot of this stuff was custom made. So it was a Shoei, S-H-O-E-I. It was funny. We used to call it the Shoei candy, kind of candy store. If you had any kind of a name at all, you could walk in there and you'd walk out with 3 helmets. And I'd take these motocross helmets, and they had like a fiberglass chin that went out in front, but it wasn't what I wanted. And so we chopped that off and we put it on a hinged one. And it literally made that helmet one with my head. If that much weight just moves a few, I don't know, maybe even an inch or two, that leverage of it moving is going to injure you severely. So when I latched that closed, it wasn't super comfortable, but the camera wasn't going to move. And that's the only way back then I could handle it. Now I got a much lighter helmet made by Bonehead, and it's very versatile. And even though cameras are getting smaller, that gives me the opportunity to bring more cameras. So you can have more mounted vertical and more mounted horizontal and different lenses. So I still wear a lot of cameras, but it's now it gives me more variety of cameras I can put on there. And you can buy a great custom helmet right from a company like Bonehead, and you don't have to do much to make it work for you. Back then it was all, like I said, we built everything. We built the batteries for our movie cameras. We built the switches. I mean, it was crazy.
Tom, how did you get into Hollywood? What was the branch into that commercial work from Drop Zone to work off the Drop Zone?
I was probably at the best location Drop Zone in the world, which was Lake Elsinore. At the time, there was Lake Elsinore in Paris. But when I first started jumping, I think maybe Lake Elsinore was a little bit better well-known than Paris was. I mean, I literally would be at the Drop Zone because I'm filming the first jump students, and Carl Banish would show up, or Randy DeLuca, or a guy named the God Flicker that a lot of guys don't know, M. Anderson Jenkins. And every weekend was Ray Cottingham and his cohort, Kevin Donnelly. And Ray and Kevin were doing a lot of the Hollywood jobs. And Ray kind of just was so generous that I could ask him the simplest questions. And now I know they're simple answers, but to me, they were complicated. And he would nearly miss airplanes to explain things to me. And so Ray Cottingham and that whole being close to Hollywood, it was a natural. Just like Paris and Lake Elsinore, they still get a lot of the film projects because that's where they're located. And that keeps the camera flyers today doing, you know, the Tom Cruise movies and things like that. But I was at the right place at the right time. And unfortunately, right about the time I started, M. Anderson Jenkins, who they called the God Flicker, and he was a character. He was a real professional studio cameraman in Hollywood shooting, I don't know if it was models or Coke cans, but he was a professional photographer, and he was a high-end skydiving cameraman, and he could shoot movies and stills. And he dressed in this, it was like yellow and black, like a leopard jumpsuit. It was just wild. And he wasn't easy to approach. He was about the only one that kind of had an attitude, and he wasn't going to tell you anything. He was a nice guy, but not about any of his secrets photography-wise. But he ended up drowning, landing in Lake Elsinore, filming for the magazine show called PM Magazine. They were doing some kind of a skydiving thing. Carl Banish ended up dying on a base jump. Randy DeLuca died at 38 years old from a disease they think might have happened from flying aircraft in the military with Agent Orange. So all of a sudden, you just turn around, and there's Kevin and Ray, and I was their protege. And they just brought me up along the way. They taught me everything I needed to know to literally take their job away, but it never bothered them. And when the phone started ringing more for me, it was really nice because I could call them up, and I could hire them. And they were just so gracious to me. They taught me everything.
I've met Mr. Cottingham, and he is a gentleman and very humble.
Very humble. Brilliant photographer and cinematographer. And keep in mind that we didn't have anything automatic in the days. You're still camera. You're shooting slide film back then. If you were off a third of an f-stop or more, it was basically almost a throwaway picture, maybe two-thirds of a stop. And that's like not one click of the lens. And you're on the ground, it's one kind of lighting. You're in the air, it's another kind of lighting. And you fly around the formation, and it's changes lighting where the sun's not behind you, it's on the side or whatever. So you really had to know your stuff back then. And so there was a lot that Ray taught me. But we'd be in the airplane together as I was a pretty solid cameraman, and we'd still be going, what do you think? Oh, F5.6. He goes, yeah, 5.6, maybe halfway to 8, you know. So we always were helping each other along the way. But I could have never, ever done it without someone like Ray and Kevin.
Do you remember your first paying gig?
I remember the first time I ever shot with a 35mm movie camera, but I don't remember what my first paying gig would be. In the early days, I was pretty good. I'd find out about a new video system or something, and I would approach these people, and I would get free equipment, and then I would do something in trade. Like, I've got free equipment from JVC, you know, the video company, and Technicolor and all that. So some of the first stuff was where I didn't get paid, but I got $3,000 worth of video equipment for me and $3,000 for Ray, but Ray had to film me. And there's a situation there. He's way more the cameraman than me, but I got the little gig, and we're both getting free equipment. He didn't care that they were making a big deal about me when he was the big deal. So there was a lot going on, but it just worked out so well that when my name got to be kind of big as a cameraman, they would call me. And they would call me pretty early on, and I would explain to them that I really needed to be the stunt coordinator as well, because I look at it like a chef isn't going to let somebody just go buy any ingredients and then you have to cook it. I needed to be in charge of all the ingredients. And Ray and Kevin taught me a lot about what to be able to do in Hollywood, because they want a certain thing and they think you're going to do it a certain way, and it might be just completely deadly to do it the way they want it to be done. And I've got lots of examples, but without getting it too long, you have to get them what they want, but do it safely. And you have to be willing to say no to a director. So there's a lot of non-photographic things that I had to learn to deal with directors, where they can't push you into doing something unsafe. And if the weather is bad, you just have to say it's time to go drink beer. And quite frankly, in a Hollywood job, then nobody gets hurt and you get paid for another day of work. You know, so they taught me a lot.
I imagine the coordination would have started in probably somewhere between 85 and 88, but it's the demo into the Olympic Games, the opening ceremonies. I remember watching that. Give us a little bit of a story behind the scenes. How did you even get involved with that project?
So that goes back to BJ Wirth and Mirror Image. They were the three-time world champion eight-way team. And they were actually looking for a drop zone that would sponsor them. And Elsinore had been flooded out. And so I had moved back to where I grew up, San Diego area, and I was running a photography business at Otay Lakes, which is now, I think, Skydive San Diego. Really beautiful place to skydive, really nice smooth wind off the ocean every day. It was still back in the day around canopies, and we were doing AFF there and tandem there. And I had the photography concession, and some guy rolled in one day, and it was BJ Wirth. I don't know what he knew about me. I probably knew quite a bit about him, but he needed a cameraman. And that was another kind of turning point in my life, where I was willing to commit. And we did two seasons where I didn't get paid to work as the team cameraman, but I got all of my jumps free and I got all my equipment free, and I got to learn a lot filming wise. I'd be exiting ninth out of a DC-3 or ninth out of an Arava, which was an airplane that looked like a football, and it really fine tuned your flying skills. But I became BJ Wirth's cameraman after Randy DeLuca died. And even before he died, he was phasing out of filming the teams and stuff and doing more Hollywood stuff. So I was the next guy in line. So any projects that BJ got, or any projects that Ray got, or any projects that I got, I tended to be on all of them. It worked out really, really well. And so I was BJ's cameraman, and he had been working for years and years on trying to get skydiving as an Olympic sport. And somewhere along the line, it turned out that it was going to be part of the Olympic opening ceremonies entertainment. And so BJ put me in charge of that. Randy was still alive. I asked him to be on it, and I think he knew at the time he was dying. I had no idea he was dying of this. I don't know if it was a cancer or something, but he didn't make it until we did the jump. But I also had Norman Kent on there and Ken Crabtree. Ken Crabtree was the Visions, which is the core skydiving, which became Visions, and most of those guys got involved with Oakley Sunglasses, and half of those guys are multi-millionaires for that whole journey. But there were three or four really big teams back there. There's U.S. Army Golden Knights, there was Mirror Image, and there was Visions. And so Ken was Visions cameraman, but he also, his profession was like live video systems for TV networks. So he built our live video systems. So it was a really strong team. Norm Ken actually recommended Ken to me. And so that was how the team of three came about, is I was selected by BJ, and then I selected Norman and Ken.
I imagine that job was very stressful. I mean, A, in terms of the building of the rings, for those, firstly, let me just preface this, because there's a new generation of skydivers that A, may have never seen that demo, and B, don't know who BJ Wirth is. And so just a quick history on that, the jump into the opening ceremonies was a formation skydive forming the five Olympic rings, and everyone wearing jumpsuits that color coordinated with the color of each Olympic ring. Furthermore, BJ Wirth, of course, is a legend in skydiving and most probably well known for his work as a stunt person for James Bond. Seems even crazy that I have to explain that, but I want everyone to be clued in. So was there a lot of stress in A, like, you got to nail this both in practice and in real time. And if I'm not mistaken, there was weather issues on the actual day of the opening ceremony. So I'll say no more. Can you expound on just like the stress of putting this thing together and pulling it off while the world is watching?
Yeah, there was a lot of stress. I'll start at the end. By the time we did the actual jump into the ceremonies, I mean, you got the best of the best of the best in front of and behind the cameras. We just went and did it. I don't think anybody worried at all. It was like in our DNA by that time. And we had had lots of practice. The Army provided the Chinook helicopters for us civilians to jump with the U.S. Army Golden Knights, which was the Yellow Ring, to practice in Davis, California, all color coordinated. I have beautiful stills. I was shooting the practice jumps and the jump into the Olympics with a Hasselblad still camera. So was Norman and so was Ken. I had a 35mm movie camera. They both had a 16mm, and then we had still 35mm cameras, and then we had live video transmitters. So we had it covered. And that's what's sad to me these days, is that we were forced, if you were going to film it at all, you had to do it right. And there was a little fine line where you could jump a 16 or a 35mm movie camera, and I just went nuts because I could do it. You didn't have a mediocre option. And what's sad to me is to see everything shot. I think the greatest stunt I've ever seen is when Luke Akins jumped out and without a parachute and landed in a net. And I never saw any stills, and I don't know if it was the Parachutist magazine didn't want to run any, but I also noticed I never saw anybody with a still camera on their head. They had GoPros. And GoPros are a pretty fantastic video camera, but it's a horrible still camera. So we were forced to do it right back there. I've spent all of my Hollywood money because I'd be invited on a project with BJ where it deserved the very, very best. And so to finish up on the Olympics, when we first started, we got to do practice, but there was a lot of pressure on the camera team, particularly me, because and I don't know if I've ever even brought it up to BJ or not, but I'm picking on him. He just knew that if he told me he needed something, it would be done. So he told me, oh, and by the way, we're required to do live video transmission of skydiving. This is 1985 or six, something like that. We did a practice jump into Korea, into the stadium with a smaller group like the year before, but there was no more than like a year and a half before actual jump. He dumps on me, yeah, you're in charge of the Olympic skydiving camera team, but we have to have live video. Okay. And just the live video system, if I hadn't gotten Canon cameras to sponsor our team, I don't know who would have paid for it. It's no blame of the sport, but I filmed the President of the United States, and it was organized with BJ Wirth and the United States Parachute Association. But the two different times I've done it, there was never any cost covered by anybody but the cameraman. I mean, our airfare wasn't covered, our movie film wasn't covered, our camera gear wasn't covered. So there was that pressure when you're doing something in the Olympics. We have to develop a system that's never been done. And so that was where it was for us. We were so good at filming the jumpers, and they were so good, they didn't move, you know. The filming part was a lot easier than it would have been filming an a mediocre group of skydivers. And I'm sure there was a lot of pressure on the guys, but I have to say, at least for me, I remember that Olympic day jump, and the night before it rained, and we had a low show plan, but it could be a no show even if it's really bad weather. And we woke up before sunrise because we had to take all of this receiving equipment up on top of the stadium before people were showing up at the stadium. So we were out there probably at sunrise, and it was a crystal clear blue day, so we didn't have to any weather to deal with. And we had practice this. And we just went and did it. I mean, they just nailed it. And I think it was just that everybody, it would be like a Super Bowl football team that is just so good that they just do things that make it look easy. So we were ready.
Tom, I'm going to put this in the show notes. If anyone's not seen this, please do look at this video. When I watch that video, Tom, what's so amazing to me is it just seems like there are jumpers just landing for days in that stadium. I mean, I don't know how many people were on the actual demo itself, but it also seemed like there were other jumpers that were not in the rings, if I'm not mistaken. So it was like a ton of jumpers. It was like as if being at the drop zone and watching 100 way. I mean, it's just like, you know, canopy after canopy, but also it was like electric. right? Like, even as I recall it, I have goosebumps, right? Because the Olympics then, I think, were even more popular than they are now. I would say that watching the opening ceremonies of the Olympics is like watching the Super Bowl. So you literally had a global audience watching your work. I can't imagine what that pressure. I don't even feel like today's air-to-ground transmission is even all that great. I agree the Luke Aikens jump was the best I've seen, but it's not like it's really advanced. You're showing it to the world. And what I'm most curious about, too, is when you land, how does that feel? Because the adulation, the noise from everybody, and knowing, oh, my God, you pulled it off. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. And the reason why there are so many canopies is, I believe, the year before we did like an accuracy competition, and it was basically a demo to show the Olympic Organizing Committee that we could land in a stadium. And unfortunately, one girl of the accuracy from one country landed on top of the stadium. But somehow we still got permission to go move forward with it because the jumpers that were in the final select, you know, made it in the stadium, I presume. But they had like two jumpers from many, many, many countries. Because it was in South Korea, the event, there were a lot of South Koreans that got to jump in. But they brought in banners, or not banners, but kind of like streamers, colored streamers. And so they were parachute after parachute after parachute. They were kind of like the canopy performance, which was like the warm-up act right before we jumped. And then there was the 30 jumpers in the ring plus the three free-fall cameramen. So then we had 33 more coming in. And we had all practiced our landings where the red group would come in together, the yellow group would come in together. And it did go off perfectly. And so there was a sigh of relief when you land in the stadium because you just know it was perfect. It was very easy stadium landing. It was enormous. I think that there was at least 100,000 spectators in the stadium. There wasn't an empty seat. And we broadcast it to over a billion viewers, a billion with a B.
Gosh.
That was a big deal. It was really fun. And then I had every magazine in the world, every publication, they were all after the three of us. And we were all using Fuji film back then. It was just this beautiful film that we used for decades. And there was Fuji lab there. And we went there. They literally processed our film within like an hour after the jump. We did this as a team. No matter what photo was selected, we had the name of all three cameramen and then Canon cameras on there. But we got the Centerfolds in Time magazine and Stern magazine, which is a huge German magazine. And it was all over the world. One of the magazines, they wanted an exclusive for their country. So, you know, we actually were able to make a little bit of money. I have almost never made money off of selling photos. Well, I've never made money selling photos to skydivers, okay? Even when you sell them, you might make an individual on that one, but I spent 10 times that amount going there, getting there, and getting the photos. I've never made a profit selling photos to experienced skydivers. That's not a business that I could figure out. And I gave a lot of them away for free. Any film project I was on, I gave every skydiver all free stuff on everything we did. I'm sure that all the Olympic rings jumpers, I don't recall selling them to them. But we were able to sell it to magazines all over the world. It actually became, without any question, the pinnacle moment of the opening ceremonies. So it was after the Olympics, it was, you know, shown many, many times on TV shows, and it was published all over the world.
It's hard for me to really imagine that there's been anything more spectacular. I mean, I've seen some spectacular performances of the Olympics, but that has to be one of the top five. And if I'm not mistaken, I think what prompted that was at the 84 games in LA, you know, they had a guy fly around the stadium with a jetpack, and, you know, that sort of set the tone that for the Seoul games, they really needed to try and, you know, come up with something even more impressive, which they did.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it ever happened because particularly back then, skydiving wasn't a big deal. Nobody knew much about it. You know, Point Break was a huge, huge positive thing for skydiving, and the Olympic rings jump was a huge positive thing for skydiving.
Obviously, we're going to get ready to talk about Point Break, but before we get there, Craig Gerard was on this program not long ago, and he talked about, you know, I said, hey, you know, of all the celebrities that you've met in your career, who really stands out to you? And he said, George Bush and his wife, Barbara. And of course, you shot the, you know, you captured video and photography for George Bush's AFF jump, but I think he was 75.
I think his first one, he was 72. I could be wrong, but I think he was 72 on his first one. So I filmed his very first AFF jump. That was in Yuma, Arizona at the U.S. Army Proving Grounds. They used the Sky Van from Eloy. And we had practice AFF jumps that we did with people before that. But yeah, I jumped with him at the Proving Grounds. And then when he was going to open up his presidential library in College Station, Texas, which is right next to that university, I don't know if it's A&M or something like that, he did another AFF jump into that lawn in front of his presidential library. So he skydived in, landed there, walked over and opened the door to his library. That's how he opened his presidential library, was with a skydive. He really, really, well, keep in mind, the reason he was alive was because of a parachute. He had to bail out during the war. There was three people in the aircraft, and the only one that survived was him. And it was because he had a parachute and used it. And so he was pretty fond of parachutes. And the PIA organized it when he had said, oh, I always wanted to do it better, because he hit the aircraft on the bailout. And so we went and did that jump. He did a terrific job. He was so good in free fall, and he was smiling, and he loved it, and he did a really great landing. And then he jumped into his presidential library, and then he still continued to go on when he was too frail. So all the remaining jumps were tandems, so I never filmed any of the tandems. And they were done usually with the U.S. Army Golden Knights, that kind of thing, doing the tandems and all that, which made all the sense in the world. But I jumped with him twice. And I'd have to agree with Craig, as I met a lot of great celebrities, but yeah, he would be him and Barbara. I have a good Barbara story, because during the jump in Yuma, I wanted to get a shot of him boarding the aircraft. So I'm in the sky van, and you know, jump airplanes don't have any upholstery. You haul all that around. So you got all the cables of a sky van up there. It couldn't be a more bare down, bare bones aircraft than a jump plane. And so I'm in there, and Barbara Bush walks in ahead of George. He wasn't even walking towards the aircraft yet. And she walked in, and she kind of looked around, and she said, I've flown in better. And I said, yeah, like Air Force One. And she laughed. She goes, yeah. And so she walked out. But she was really fun to be around there. She supported him. She was happy about it. I think she thought he was just crazy George. She was always really, really pleasant to be around. When Jan died, they sent me a card, so it's pretty nice to get from the president. He's a really nice guy.
You know, for those that can't see this, that definitely touches you, class act. Let's pivot. I want to get a couple more stories from you. One thing that I read is that during the filming of Drop Zone with Wesley Snipes, you had a night cutaway. You know, cutaway during the day. It's exciting enough. Night cutaway with an enormous camera on your helmet. I think if I read a 35 millimeter Aeroflex, tell me about that story.
Well, the reason it ended up being a 35 millimeter Aeroflex is at the start of the movie Drop Zone, and that turned out to be 3 months of work for me and Norman Kent, and we got Gus Wayne to get a few jumps during the job, but it was 3 months of day and nighttime jumps. And it was great paycheck. You know, we're in the Screen Actors Guild. It's a Screen Actor Guild job. Lots of stunt adjustments and overtime, because they wanted to get it done. They were willing to pay the money. So we literally would skydive all day long. And then we'd skydive at night, but we were young and tough and we were getting paid a lot of money. It was fun. There was a night scene. The whole premise of the movie is in Drop Zone, if you haven't seen it, is that to find out who the DEA agents are, they can't get in the building from the bottom up, because there's security, but they can skydive on and get in. So there's a lot of jumps onto buildings, which is something that I'd put down as a note, is that's the most challenging thing I've ever done in my life. I've jumped off of buildings, and that's fun. Jumping onto buildings is about the only time I'd say I was really quite concerned in my life jumping. And I've done a lot of jumps, but I'm usually so focused on the camera work that I don't let my emotions take over during it. But in Drop Zone, we were doing a night jump, and we had a four-way. I had Norman Kent and Gus Wing flying lights, and I was the cameraman with the 35 millimeter. And the reason why I was using a standard Aeroflex, the same thing that you would see on the ground that Steven Spielberg would be using at the time. It was enormous. It was just this huge lead weight. And I believe I had video. I know I have stills because I remember getting stills from this. So I have a four-way. I couldn't use a flash, but the movie lights lit it up enough that I've got some really cool images at night over downtown Miami. I remember that the scene was supposed to be where I'm sitting there filming, and I think Kate Cooper was on it, whoever the four jumpers were. I think Guy Manos was one of them. They would do a pullout one at a time. And so they all pulled out, and then the two camera flyers left, and then I pulled. So I was, you know, not at a really high altitude, and I had a spinning malfunction. I ended up cutting it away, and where our landing area was a concrete area next to the harbor right in downtown Miami. That was our intentional landing area. I've been fortunate enough to get a lot of free equipment over the years, and for some reason in that rig, I don't even know what a cricket is, but I think the parachute was a cricket. It was just super, super small. And when I came in no wind with all of that weight and flared, I slid about 40 yards across the concrete with my head on the back of my helmet on the ground, and there were sparks coming off. It was a titanium magazine, and it was causing sparks to go across as I was sliding across the area there. But I didn't get hurt. There's no way I was going to pull off a stand-up landing. Evidently, there was a helicopter flying around that was part of our film crew that had no business being in the air, and they almost hit my cutaway. And that was the most exciting cutaway I ever had. It was at night with huge cameras and landing on concrete.
Unbelievable. Did Wesley Snipes actually jump in that movie, or was there a stunt double for him?
No, we had stunt doubles. I don't know if he did any kind of jump, but he did do some of the scenes show the outdoor wind tunnel. And I believe he did quite a bit of shots in the wind tunnel. But the only jumpers, I mean, there was in the early days of skydiving at Elsinore, there was a real famous singer named Paul Williams that was an active, experienced skydiver. Patrick Swayze ended up making about 60 jumps for a Point Break. But again, most of it is not Patrick in the movie, all right? Well, most of the filming, we were doing the second unit, which is the stunt people. We were at Lake Powell building the star over the lake and all that kind of stuff. Patrick got good enough. He would have been fine in that, but he was doing first unit, and they wouldn't even let him go do any skydiving. He was sneaking over to the drop zone to do that kind of stuff. So my point here is usually the actors – I can't act – And actors can't skydive at our level. I mean, we're at the top of our business in skydiving doing what we do. So it's very rare. Tom Cruise, he's legit. He's got hundreds and hundreds of skydives. I was asked to film his first skydive when he was on Days of Thunder. He just wanted to make a skydive, and the caterer was a good friend of mine that owned Lake Elsinore Parachute Center before it flooded out. And he said, hey, I'm the caterer on Tom Cruise's movies. He was such a good caterer that his company called Four Stars Catering was in the contract. When Tom Cruise had a movie, my skydiving buddy, he was the caterer. He called me up, and he's in Daytona Beach doing Days of Thunder. And he says, Tom Cruise wants to make a jump. Where should he go? And I go, you're right down the road from DeLand, you know. So I told him about that, and he goes, okay, well, we want to bring you out. So he brought me out there, and I don't like showing up at a drop zone and taking the really, really awesome job that a drop zone cameraman can do just as well. And they worked there full time. And everybody wanted to jump with Tom Cruise. So I said, okay, I'll jump with her. And I didn't know who it was, but it was Nicole Kidman. So I jumped with Nicole Kidman a couple of times. And Tom Cruise made a couple of jumps. I recall hearing he bought a couple of rigs for him and Nicole. Of course, they split up down the road, as happens in Hollywood. But he's got hundreds of jumps now. And I know Craig O'Brien Craig O'Brien was in, I think, Dubai or something for a long, long time, where they were just doing practice jumps during the day and then filming in the morning and the evening for one of his movies.
If you're a fan of the 20-Minute Call, I'd like to invite you to be a member of a budding community with me on Patreon. By becoming a patron of the show, you can join me behind the scenes to discuss options for future guests and gain access to some show swag. It's pretty sweet. Details on how to become a patron can be found in the show notes. Okay, back to the show. I imagine, Tom, that's the gig, right? I mean, those blockbuster films is what everyone's hoping to get on. You grind and grind and grind, and then there's the pay. Is that the pay dirt, really?
Yeah, and when you say pay dirt, I don't even think we're thinking of the money, because you know, we make good money, but you're only working for a day or two or 3 days normally, so it's not like you have a full-time gig. Drop Zone was a totally different thing. I worked 3 months on it, and it was the only reason I could afford to make my film Over the Edge. Everything was expensive back then. Keep in mind that if anything was important, I had to shoot it with movie film and high-quality stills, and I still, 45 years later, have everything in air-conditioned, climate-controlled vaults. I've been paying to store my enormous library. Just to store it is tens of thousands of dollars. But you couldn't go shoot anything cheap. Couldn't do anything cheap. And so, you know, it was really nice to get a job like that, but you still weren't coming out financially that well if it's only a 1 or a 2 or a 3 day job. But it was, for me, the pinnacle of those kind of jobs was shooting 4 scenes in James Bond movies. It was 3 James Bond movies, but I got to shoot the opening and the closing of my first James Bond movie, which was The Living Daylights. And I don't know if anybody could even track this down, but I don't know if there's been a cameraman that got to film the stunt at the beginning and the end of the movie. BJ would submit ideas to Cubby Broccoli and the crew, and you know, the family that produced the Bond films. He was real tight with them, and he would come up with most of the ideas. And they liked it enough that the opening and the closing of The Living Daylights involved skydiving. So I shot both.
Was that the opening scene with the skiing?
No, the skiing was probably Rick Sylvester, and that was the one where the parachute opens and it's like a British flag, if that's the one. Yeah, I wasn't on that one. That was pretty early on. There was one where a guy rides a motorcycle off of a cliff and then gets and flies into an airplane. I think that was GoldenEye. And I worked on Tomorrow Never Dies, but The Living Daylights, the opening scene, I have to have a beauty shot of the Rock of Gibraltar and the Bond agents, 007 and 2 or 3 others, enter my frame and then track away. That was in the opening scene. And then they land, and it's supposed to be a military practice, but it turns out they're getting shot for real. And then the end of the movie is quite a classic Bond stunt scene where, of course, back then you could show that a girl couldn't fly an airplane. So Bond hears some noise in the back of a C-130. He leaves the girl in charge, and the plane's going up and down and crazy and out of control. And when he goes back there, the big cargo net, which was this was supposed to happen in Afghanistan, and it was supposed to be first aid stuff or drugs, I don't know which. She pulls the wrong handle, and Bond and the bad guy, they go out on a net and just literally in tow behind the C-130. So I got to go out on the net, and we filmed the fight scene out on a net that's literally for real in tow behind a C. I think they used a C-123. You could only tell the difference if you could see all 4 engines. So I had to be careful what I shot, but we were literally out on the net filming that. So that was the closing scene stunt.
I know exactly the scene you're talking about. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome being out there. It's pretty crazy. I mean, just to give you an idea how something like that works, we were filming in Palm Springs area. I can't remember the name of the little airport out there, but we took off, and we would be flying parallel with the highway, but it had to be so that any air-to-air filming from aircraft or helicopters wouldn't pick up highway because it was supposed to be Afghanistan. If I was on the net, I wasn't supposed to be able to see any highways. But there were literally a fight going on. BJ and Jake Lombard were the two stuntmen, and they're fighting on the net. And there were times that BJ actually got knocked off the most at first, and he's Bond in that particular movie. So after like the third time that BJ gets knocked off the net, we all land together out in the middle of the desert on the side of the highway. And somehow, I don't know if he got some kind of a satellite phone for production, but that's how we tell him where we were. We would land out there, and you'd go, I guess it was something like Necro 3, Bond 0, because the bad guy character was N-E-C-R-O. I think it was Necro. But BJ got knocked off the net during the fight multiple times. And then there was a scene where the bad guy's holding onto a boot, and Bond reaches down and cuts his laces, and he has to fall off. So on all of those, we landed out in the middle of the desert and had our pickup crew come find us. Some crazy things on some of the Bond movies.
Incredible.
Yeah. I got one other story when we're jumping through clouds that I'll tell you if we have time.
On one of the Bond films?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I definitely would like to come back to that. I think I would be remiss if we didn't go a little bit deeper into Point Break. It revolutionized skydiving. I mean, countless people listening to this podcast were probably influenced by that movie, me included.
I've heard that a lot. I've heard lots of people saying that's why I got into skydiving. Skydiving was not on the radar of the general public in 1988. Probably if you were an active skydiver, you might get some of your skydiving friends to come out and get into it. But it wasn't something that you did because you're in college and you're all going to go do something. Like nowadays, I personally don't think you can get through something like college without having made a skydive. It's just, it's a normal thing. Back then, it was not even something anybody even thought of or heard of. It was always out in the outskirts of big cities, and it was never on the news.
So I'm sure you had no concept that this movie that I'm shooting with, you know, it's like it's another gig, is going to revolutionize the sport that you've been enjoying for a long time.
No, I had no idea that it would be that successful, but I got to work side by side with Kevin Donnelly. He was the stunt coordinator, who was like, him and Ray were my main two mentors. And Ray also did a lot of film work on it. A lot of times I get all the credit. Ray wasn't available all the days, but he even was in front of the camera as one of the guys during a hard landing stunt. And he jumped camera a lot, and he did pick up shots at Paris with me where we were trying to get shots that we couldn't show the drop zone because it had to cut with Lake Powell. So it was up angle type stuff, and he was better at filming freestyle. So him and I worked together with Patrick in a real small crew with just Kevin, Ray, and Patrick and I out at Paris one day.
I've read that you found Patrick Swayze to be just like an incredible regular human being.
Unbelievably nice, very humble. He felt really comfortable just sitting down at a picnic table at the drop zone, and he was always friendly, always had time for people. He was a very, very good human being. He was really awesome. I can't think of anything other than he was just so nice to be around. And his brother Don Swayze is also really nice. Don Swayze has thousands of skydives and many, many hundreds of base jumps. He's very experienced at that. But he was busy doing something else, so he didn't even get to double his brother, and they look real similar. But Patrick was just super nice, very humble.
Who's impressed you? You know, you've worked with a lot of people. I'll ask that question both. Who in skydiving has really impressed you in terms of their professionalism, but their approachability? And the same on the professional side within the world of Hollywood.
Well, you know, in Hollywood, we almost never actually deal with the actors at all. That's just a perception. They think that these guys are doing jumps and stuff like that. So, you know, the only ones I've ever met celebrity-wise would be someone like President Bush or Patrick Swayze, a very rare case of something like that. So it's not much of a choice. But, you know, I could just say, even though I got to know Tom Cruise really quite well, he was such a megastar that when he showed up at DeLand, and this was back in the 80s, I mean, it was a real production. It almost felt like the Secret Service with the police were coming up. And if you came down with a jump from Nicole's jump, even if you only shot 13 pictures and had, you know, a roll of 36, they didn't want you to keep the roll of film. They took it and they'll give you another one. So everything was super, super controlled around Tom Cruise. He's very, very nice. When Jan died, he sent me a card to express his sadness. So very, very thoughtful people. But he was just such a megastar that I don't know if he had any other way. It was a bit of a circus around him. Patrick Swayze would just show up on his own. And quite frankly, he wasn't letting the studio know that he was jumping. They were letting him do some surfing. And I'm a surfer and a skydiver. And I will tell you, the hardest sport is surfing. And they were trying to get him to do some of the shots surfing. And you can't teach someone to surf overnight. You could learn way faster in a wind tunnel and skydive. And Patrick, with 50 or 60 jumps, he could do real basic, good stuff. He could have been in that star for sure. But anyway, he was just coming out on his own. He didn't bring any security. He didn't bring any big hoopla with him. He just showed up quiet. And so it was probably the one that was a nice experience, where being around Tom Cruise was fun and exciting, but it was like it was just too much of this big presence. And I don't know that it was his intent. I think he was just that big a star that it just comes with the territory.
I read a very funny story that your friend Craig Hansen was on the drop zone, and, you know, a bunch of you guys were in the plane, and he sort of peered in going, "Hey, I hear there's a star on the drop zone." And Patrick Swayze was right there. Do you want to recall that?
Yeah. And that was a cool thing, because Patrick just seemed like one of the bunch, you know, and to some degree, I think skydivers in general, once you become an experienced skydiver, you do get a little presence about yourself that, you know, yeah, you're an actor. You're lucky you get paid a lot of money, and hopefully you like to do your job. But we're not like overly impressed. And, you know, it's like with Patrick, you know, it would be just as many. How many jumps do you have would be more interesting to a skydiver than other things. So he got along fine. And he was in the aircraft and Craig peered in and he had heard that somebody was on the drop zone and Craig was getting it all confused up. And then somebody pointed to Patrick and he said, well, what have you been in? And I can't remember the movies, but he'd say something like Roadhouse or Dirty Dancing or something. And every time Craig would go, no, I never saw that. No, I never saw that. And then, you know, eventually we took off. Craig got in and we took off. But it was real funny that, you know, here we had Patrick Swayze, who was quite a very, very, very big deal at the time. And we have a skydiver that doesn't even know who the hell he is. It was funny.
You've got so many great stories. So thank you for indulging me further. I want to talk about a jump you did in 99, where you had another live transmission for a TV audience. And you guys were jumping into Aloha Stadium and there was like a bunch of Colonel Sanders. So I'm assuming this was maybe for a KFC commercial, but the stadium had really high bleachers on all sides and it was a pretty windy day. And it was a pretty scary jump. Do you recall that?
Yep. I drive by it all the time. It's right down the road and we call it Brokeback Stadium. And this is where I'd like to say something. I don't know if it would have turned out differently, but I like being the stunt coordinator on jobs that I do. BJ coordinated some jobs, and I would go along with that. And there was a few others, but a lot of people know me as the cameraman. But I'm really meticulous to detail, and I've been a pilot now out here flying an $80,000 powered hang glider downwind of two volcanoes on the windiest place on planet Earth. The spinning of planet Earth causes our trade winds, so they're here almost every day. And I fly a 32-foot kite, and I have 8,000 hours doing it. I've never broken a fingernail. With skydiving, I never, ever, ever got hurt on a job that I coordinated. And originally, I was going to be in charge of the parachutes. And the funny thing about those jumps, and I don't know if there was 2 days of jumping, but I remember that we're, you know, the high paid guys that are coming in to do this stunt. And it was, I don't remember if it was live. It might have been live, but it was for Kentucky Fried Chicken. It was like a publicity stunt thing. It was during like the Aloha Bowl. And it's a horrible stadium to jump into. Very, very narrow. Like the jumping in the Olympic Stadium, it was just enormous, okay? It was like jumping into the drop zone at Deland, it felt like. Jumping into this one is horrible. It's real high, like you said, real narrow. It's like a really small bowl. Then they had the cable cam stuff that they have to film football games that you had to avoid. And on the practice jump, Jim Wallace, on the practice jump, the guy that did the stunt coordinating got hurt so bad that he didn't jump on the day of the jump. And he had originally put me in charge of the parachutes we were going to use. And I was going to use bigger, slower parachutes. He had been sponsored doing crew by another company. So even though nothing was going wrong and everything was on time, he decided, I think he felt bad that this company had sponsored him so well for so many years and we weren't going to use his. He took that away from me. And so he coordinated it and they all ordered much smaller parachutes. And I literally had to go to my sponsor PD and get a smaller canopy than I normally jump because my job was to follow them around. And the only way to follow them around easily is to be compatible in the canopy size. So I was jumping a smaller parachute than I normally do into a really, really dicey situation. It was an AstroTurf, which the way I hit it, it felt exactly like concrete. But I remember that the coordinator of this jump got hurt so bad on the practice jump, he didn't jump. And I think either that day or the day of the Aloha jumps, I remember seeing the local jumpers from out here, and they all came in with these big accuracy canopies, and they're getting pushed around all over the place, and they all landed great, and they all walked away. And we were coming in with our much faster parachutes. Jim Wallace landed in front of me, and he just whacked in. And I came in behind him, and that was the only time in my life that I actually was conscious, and I thought, maybe I'm dead. Because I hit the ground so hard that it knocked all of the air out of me. And I remember getting up to my hands and knees, and I think I was trying to just prove to myself that I am actually alive, but I couldn't hold my breath. Everything had gotten knocked out of me. And I don't remember who took off my helmet. I don't remember who would have unconnected my cables and everything. I don't know if I've ever watched the video, but I heard there was a huge groan in the entire stadium when I hit. I think because of the adrenaline, and I'm stubborn, I walked off the stadium, walked, and I remember waving to the crowd, and I walked straight to the paramedics, and I said, I think I need to go to the hospital. And it turned out I'd broken my back. So that was a jump I would like to take back. It was a very high-paying jump, but I wish we would have used different equipment, and that decision kind of got out of my control because I wasn't running the job and I had to either say no to the job. But I thought, you know, I really don't want to jump this canopy, but I'm probably not going to get hurt. You know, I'm not arrogant or over conceited like that way, but I figured, you know, it's just like, I'm pretty good at doing PLFs. I'm from the old school. I've hit a few times hard with all the camera gear and landing at night on top of buildings is probably the gnarliest thing I've ever done in my life. And I never got hurt. So I figured that I'd be okay, but I was the one that got the broken back.
How long did that set you back in terms of recovering and then eventually getting back in the air?
I think it was about 6 months. I mean, they told me as soon as I could walk up and down the stairs in the hospital, I could go home. And so I really pushed myself on that. And I think they were a little surprised. But I think within 6 months, I was back jumping. And it felt really good to get in the air and do a jump and know that during opening shock. And of course, I didn't wear cameras the first jump, but it didn't take me a real long time. But I'm certain that the pain that I feel every single day would not be here if I hadn't have done that one jump. There was nothing even remotely close to that in my history of jumping ever. It was a really, wow, really hard hit. It was super turbulent down air, and you could be going into the wind on a base leg, and then all of a sudden you're going downwind, and you come, turn the other way, and you're going downwind the other direction. You know, it was just crazy. So you're coming in real, real fast. I remember flaring, but my canopy changed its angle, but my glide didn't change. I just whacked in super hard.
Wow.
I will tell you, though, that as bad as that felt, if you had to sign a contract, let's say, in 1978 and go, okay, you're going to get to do this, 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 and this, but you're going to have to put up with this, I would have gone, sign me up. I'm very fortunate that we did a lot of stunts. The proudest thing I am is not just my camera work, but to go do all of these stunts, and I surrounded myself by just epic people, the riggers, they built hidden parachutes, whatever we were doing, the whole crew around me were fantastic. And so they made my job easy. And we never, ever had any close calls on any job I ever coordinated. We did some crazy stuff, but every job that I coordinated, we all got to go home.
This podcast is sponsored by Beyond Marketing, the digital marketing agency for the skydiving industry. Now, I'm not a fan of lots of ads during a podcast. I mean, who likes ads? So I'll stop talking about how marvelously wonderful Beyond Marketing is. But if you're curious about what the amazing people at Beyond Marketing do to help drop zones and manufacturers thrive, then you should check out their website at dropzone.marketing. That's dropzone.marketing. Tom, you strike me as a proud man. Are you proud of what you've been able to accomplish?
Yeah, I worked hard.
It's extraordinary. You've worked hard. You've been recognized with honors of being an honorary U.S. Army Golden Knight, maybe the finest institution in parachuting.
Yeah, those things mean a lot to me. And I'm not all about the awards. I don't seek them out, but I appreciate them. USPA gave me the gold medal for meritorious service. So I'm one of the few, if I don't know who has had all three, but to get inducted into the Hall of Fame, become an honorary Golden Knight, and the gold meritorious service for USBA. I'm happy about that.
With all the work that you've done and the honors you've received, what is there a job, whether it be famous or not famous, that you take particular pride in?
I would say my film Over the Edge. Keep in mind that I was in charge of filming the Olympics, and it was seen around the world, but I had all that original footage, stills and movies. A lot of guys get into Hollywood getting really good as a mountain climbing filmer, and then they get to go to Hollywood. I got into Hollywood really early on. I had never made a film. And you don't see any of the newer cameramen making any films, and it's kind of sad, but back in the day with us, Norman Kent would make a film, and I would make a film, and there's a guy from England, Leo Dickinson. There was films being made. And it was a very expensive proposition, but I wanted to preserve the Olympics of all things. I felt it needed to be out there. So what's really cool now is even, you know, it can be on YouTube, which is all people seem to care about anymore, but you can have that clip of the jump that I edited for my film Over the Edge, and it's preserved. So I'd say being able to make Over the Edge, and I entered it in a bunch of contests, and it took first place in everything I entered it in. And it was contests that had nothing to do with skydiving. These were, you know, big film festivals. And it would win in categories that I didn't even enter it in, like best music. But it's a film that lot of people don't understand this, but everything in that film I own. There was a song called Too Much Fun, and it's a like a blues Tennessee type of song, but we got permission from the writers to rewrite the words to fit the base jumping in West Virginia for our base jumping piece. And then I had to hire a band to record it in a studio. It turned out like two of the brothers went on to be major rock stars. Last name was Bissonette or something like that. They turned out to be big, big rock stars. But in their earning their way up their ladder, they ended up doing the music for me. The guy who choreographed and wrote a lot of the music was Brian Mann, who was from Kenny Loggins. He was the pianist for Kenny Loggins of Loggins and Messina. And so everything about that film was done legally where I own everything. It's nice that it can be preserved, and it's in short little segments. Like, you can just take the Olympic segment or the skydiving in lingerie or jumping in Micronesia. Those are still entertaining today to even skydivers that are doing free flying or wingsuits or whatever. They're going to look at those jumps like the Olympics, and they're going to appreciate them. So I think it would be over the edge.
If anybody wants to watch that, how can they watch that today?
It was up on my website, and I get so busy with my flying business that I'll get it back up where there'll be a link on it. I may just end up doing something where each of the different chapters can be clicked on my website, something like that. But right now, the film is such high quality that you can't put it out on anything but a DVD. And I literally have two DVDs left, and I don't think I'm giving them away. So we're down to that. And I don't know if I'm going to make any more DVDs because the packaging and the duplication and all that, you got to order thousands of them. Do I want to spend another $10,000 for something that maybe only a few skydivers want to see at this point? I'll make it more available, like on YouTube, that kind of thing.
Isn't it available for rent on Vimeo?
If it is, I'm not making any money on it. I have to check because I know of friends of mine that wanted to show it bad enough to their family or something, and Heidi did it, and she's rented it a couple times, and I've never seen a check ever from my website on that. So I got to talk to my webmaster and find out. I don't think it's rented very much, but it'd be interesting to know that I know it's been rented and I never got a dollar. What happened?
Yeah, someone needs a talking to there. Something's not at all quite right. Tom, this has been an honor, sir, speaking with you. I love these type of interviews because I've known of your when you walk into a drop zone or when we see you at the Museum and Hall of Fame events, your resume precedes you. But I haven't been able to see a man that feels pride and emotion and really cares about his craft. That's my takeaway. Here's a man that really cares for his craft and put it all out there to the very best of his abilities. And I should mention, you're not slowing down. I mean, you've got a successful business in Hawaii, which I would wish for you to plug so that we can fly with you. But also, I see you on Rich Grimm's Boogies documenting that all the time as well. So you still love skydiving, apparently.
Oh, I do. No, I'm very passionate about skydiving and surfing and hang gliding and for a long time, base jumping. I don't know if I'll be doing any more base jumping, but, you know, I have the most base jumps off the tallest waterfall in the world, so I was very into base jumping. It's just not something that's right at the forefront for me now. But, yeah, no, I love skydiving. It looks like with Go Jump, which owns a drop zone in Las Vegas, and they own a drop zone in Oceanside, they just opened a drop zone here in Hawaii. It'll actually return jumping that I can enjoy. They're going to be doing sunset jumps, and I love sunset jumps. It seems like I love jumping without a camera, but I love jumping with cameras 100 times more. And I like doing it when the lighting is pretty. So, you know, I'm not all that excited to go jump in the middle of the afternoon when it's all sunny and not do a camera jump. So it depends on the jumping. But that's still an opportunity that we're going to have here in Hawaii that we haven't had for a number of years. It's been kind of a black hole for me for jumping. I've had to travel 3,000 miles just to make a skydive, to be honest, for years. And so that's gotten in the way a bit. But yeah, no, I love, and Rich Grimm's Boogies are phenomenal. And to be able to jump side by side with Bruno Broken, I mean, I think he's the most talented camera flyer on the planet, particularly if you're going to say, and we'll jump with real cameras. I mean, there's some things And I think the live transmission, even on Luke Aiken's jumps, was quite nice. What I miss is great quality still photos taken at the same time. The last thing I'll say about this is on all the film jobs that I did, like on the James Bond movies, they never filmed the behind the scenes of us stuntmen. They would film the actors faking the stunts. I actually mounted cameras up on the ramps of the C-130s when I was doing stunts. I have the behind the scenes of James Bond movies and all kinds of commercials. I paid crews to follow me around when I'm filming a motorcycle for Yamaha. I own all of the behind the scenes footage of my favorite projects as well. And nowadays, the camera people, they jump with red video cameras, which are a nice high quality red camera. There's some exceptions. You'll see Norm Kent bringing a steel camera along. But it'd be nice to see cameramen like that. I'm not looking for a job. I can still do it. I can jump a red and big steel camera. There are people that can do the camera flying way beyond my skills, like Norman Kent, that are out there. And he doesn't get invited on a lot of jobs that are shot with two GoPros, and they're not deserving of the stunt. You jump out of an airplane without a parachute, 20-some thousand feet, and land in a net. It'd be nice to have somebody get it with a real good quality still camera. Maybe I'm wrong. I hate to rag on that on something like this, but my biggest disappointment is everybody thinks, we just shoot everything with GoPros nowadays. No, even Tom Cruise is shot with a big red by Craig O'Brien. He's got a lot on his head, but I got to shoot the behind the scenes of those stunts as well, and I shot stills simultaneously. So like on Point Break, if there's an iconic moment, I own a still that is matching that. So the only thing I'd like to plug is I want to put out a book, and it will have these Hollywood moments with still images that are gorgeous that I own that are identical to those magic moments. And I'm going to put out a limited edition of fine art prints from James Bond movies and things like that. That's my last two goals with the photography.
I'll buy that, Tom. I will buy that. And then just to hone in on your quote-unquote complaint, I think it's because you're proud of your craft. It's like the craft is being eroded by the simplicity of throwing the GoPro on the helmet and calling it a day.
Yeah, I think the GoPro does amazing things for making the world see all the cool stuff out there. You cannot beat what it's done there. But it hasn't replaced the art of photography done properly. It's not there. It's not there at all. Put a camera on a timer and take two pictures a second on a tandem jump and it's a GoPro and you call that photography? It just doesn't work for me.
Finally, Tom, if you know you have a, I don't want to say the wrong type of aircraft that you're flying, but you have a business that we can go fly with you. Tell me about that.
So 22 years ago, we started Paradise Air, and basically I fly an $80,000 high-end hang glider, but it's a real aircraft. It can land at Honolulu Airport. You have to have a real pilot's license to fly it. But my business is similar to skydiving tandems. Just like people go up and skydive with an expert, people get to go fly with me in not a regular hang glider, which is super weather dependent, but a powered hang glider. So we take off and land from a runway, a 10,000-foot paved runway that the Army owns but lets us use it during the day. And I fly in Hawaii, so it's really a great flying experience. We quit advertising 15 years ago. My problem is nobody knows how to fly them. Hang gliding is a dying art like the photography is, too. Very few people know how to fly a hang glider. And so pilots are really not available for it. And it's not a great choice for flying late in the day in Hawaii. So I'm adding gyrocopters. And we're going to add gyrocopters with floats and wheels. They'll be amphibious. So in my flying business, I've got a couple of big goals. Like I have a couple of big goals in my photography business, but I'm expanding locations and adding aircraft in the next few years. But right now, if anybody wants to fly, it's on the North Shore of Oahu. It's by reservation only, but the company's called Paradise Air. And we're as busy as I need to be, but I always love taking up skydivers.
Amazing. You are not slowing down, Tom Sanders. What a pleasure. Man, I just know everyone's going to enjoy this. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to the 20-Minute Call podcast. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode, which is released every Monday. If you want to contact the team, our email address is podcast@beyondmarketing.xyz. This episode was edited and engineered by Garnet Snydrick of the YouTube channel Blue Skies, Fun Days. Thanks for listening, and join us next week for our next episode.